The Wetherall Institute of Molecular Medicine, based in the Clinical School at the University of Oxford, fosters research in molecular and cell biology with direct application to the study of human disease. The Institute's founding director, Sir David Wetherall, describes the origin of the Institute, some of the pioneering research that it has undertaken, and the possibilities for future advances in genomics.
So you established the Institute for Molecular Medicine in 1989. What does the Institute do, and why is it important?
I came from Liverpool, but before I joined my training, I spent nearly 5 years in the States learning bits of genetics and looking at various laboratory techniques and so on. And it was becoming apparent that there were going to be enormous opportunities for medical research from these new developments in genetics, particularly in molecular biology, cell biology. And I think in 1979, the Medical Research Council gave us what they call a unit, called it the Molecular Hematology Unit, so we could apply these techniques to the study of things like thalassemia and so on. Well, after the unit was formed, it was clear that there were other teams around the hospital doing research in various areas, and that it was clear to them as well that some of the techniques we were using at the molecular level had implications way beyond just blood disease. But the problem was in the early 80s, I mean, we couldn't look after people kind of wandering in daily by them, borrowing equipment and so on. And also, the big problem was there was nowhere you could send a young chap to be trained. They wanted to get the basics of molecular biology. Where do you send them? They could go to some great laboratory like Laboratory for Molecular Biology in Cambridge, the kind of home of Watson and Crick. But their work was not in any way disease-related. And I think a young clinical scientist, or potential clinical scientist, does want his scientific training always with one eye on what he's going to do with it in the future. So, sometime in the early, mid-80s, I went to the MRC and said, there's a building just been vacated in Oxford. There was this building called the Nuffield Institute for Medical Research on this site. The director is a very distinguished fetal physiologist, retired. The university decided to shut the building. It seemed like such a waste to me. So I went to the MRC and said, look, there's a building which will need extension and so on, but why don't we set up a building where we can have a mixture of medical scientists and basic scientists who all want to work together on the application of molecular and cell biology to study of disease, and so form a place where young medics can be trained in these techniques, but also a young PhD who's got a proper training in molecular biology can come into an environment where his training could be used towards medical problems. So the MRC liked this idea, but they didn't have enough money at the time. But the director of the MRC at the time, Jim Gowans, Sir James Gowans, was very helpful, and together we went on a fundraising expedition, and we got help from Wolfson and from the Abrams Fund in Oxford, and from a little from the Wellcome at the time, one or two others, and put this building together. Originally it was going to be just the single floor, but right at the last minute the Imperial Cancer Research Fund came in, so Walter Bodmer, who was director at the time, said they'd like to come. So they put enough money in to build another floor. Yeah, we opened it in 89. We didn't specify any particular area of research initially. Anybody who had a good clinical question which required this kind of technology was kind of welcome. But it just fell almost by default into one or two particular key areas. I mean, there was my own team in hematology, blood disease, but and then we developed a very strong immunology group. Some of the old people in the Department of Medicine at the time, and then very strong kind of genetic disease groups. And then one of my other interests has always been to develop a strong program in Oxford in global health. So we had what we called a molecular parasitology group in here, which formed the kind of basic science end of that. So those groups seem to prosper over the years. I think there's an now about 400 people in here, and we had to expand it again when I retired.
Do the groups work together quite a lot?
I hope so, yeah. No, they do. That was the tea room syndrome. I learned this in the United States, actually. I mean, the United States people never have a tea break. And so we initiated tea breaks in the labs I worked in Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. Just getting together and sitting down and talking science once or twice a day. At least I insisted on having a proper tea lounge. And we tried to prevent people taking coffee to the lab. And so they must come down here. The Americans thought it was a hell of a waste of time at first, but when I've been back to Hopkins recently, they have tea breaks. So they do get together and groups kind of intermingle, and there has been quite a lot of interactive work done in that way. I think it's more important than the lab, actually.
There have been many breakthroughs in research at the Institute.
Oh, gosh. It depends what you mean by breakthrough, really. I suppose in our own field, the early work that we did was actually converted quite quickly into methods for prenatal detection of these diseases and their prevention. There's a very strong group in here who works on the genetics of deformities of the face and so on. That's kind of moved straight off into clinical practice in the terms of being able to advise families about genetic risks and so on. The immunology group here has been very much in the kind of forefront of AIDS research. In fact, I was amazed, actually. I saw a couple of weeks ago in Science that the citations for Oxford for work in AIDS were top of the international citation list. I mean, when you think of the mounds of money that are going into these big groups in the States, and that, I think the current director, Andrew McMichael, is the director of that group, and they've done very well. Kay Davis, of course, she did a lot of her kind of work on muscular dystrophy here. We haven't cured cancer the cancer group have done a lot of excellent work as well, particularly on the concept of how cancerous growths get their blood supply and how that might be interfered with and so on. So I think there's been some pretty respectable stuff here.
You mentioned earlier that you'd wrote the report for the
WHO. Yeah.
So how important is the ongoing study of human genetics?
Well, it's a very interesting question, that. The Human Genome Project was completed, or partially completed, in about 2001. There were enormous claims that it was going to revolutionise medicine. I remember a few of us who had been involved in one way or another were invited to Downing Street for the big announcement. And we got into this little room, I think there were about 10 of us. Tony Blair walks in with a big smile on his face, and at the far end of the room this massive television screen lights up, and there's Bill Clinton with his arms around the two American protagonists of the project, one in the private sector, one in the public sector. And the whole conversation was revolved around the effect this would have on Cherry Blair was highly pregnant at that time with her last child, and how long this child would live with these wonders that were going to come from the genome. It went on like that. I mean, the press and a lot of the scientists themselves were saying, they usually use 20 years as the, I don't know why 20 years, not 15 or 25, but it's always 20, that medicine will be revolutionised, that all the common killers will be coming under control. Of course, it hasn't happened. Oh, it's not 20 years quite yet, but even so, it won't happen. The idea really is that, apart from diseases like thalassemia, which are due to a single defective gene, most common diseases that kill most, like heart disease and stroke and diabetes and so on, are not due to a single defective gene. They're due to mainly environmental factors, but acting more than one person's genes that may make them more or less susceptible probably to the environmental factors. They're called multigenic or polygenic diseases. So these huge searches around the genome for these genes will pick up a gene that makes you slightly more prone to diabetes or something else. If you look at the slightly more prone means it perhaps raises your risks by a few percent. So the idea is that if one could identify those genes and find out why they make you more prone, then just maybe they will offer the pharmaceutical industry a way into new drug development. Secondly, if one could really identify ones that have a significant effect, then one could, well, screen everybody's genome at birth, as it were, and then try to, if they're at particularly high risk for some particular environmental agent and so on, try to practice preventative medicine in that way. The cost of sequencing all your genes coming down all the time. People are now saying that, you know, in 20 years' time, maybe a bit longer, everybody will have their genome done and your risks will be all printed out. So you'll go to your GP and with a headache and he'll press a button, look at your genome, see whether you're a person who should take one aspirin or two aspirin. That's just making it a bit trivial, but that general approach. I think what the field that's been most spectacular is really in the cancer field. When I was a medical student in the 50s, I mean, we hadn't a clue what caused cancer. I mean, it's just a complete mystery. I mean, there was a little bit of knowledge about radiation and so on, and then the tobacco story kind of broke. But the actual cause, what happens to the cell, a complete black box. And it was really the molecular era that opened up that whole field with the discovery that there are genes which rather wrongly are called oncogenes, onco being the kind of root for malignancy, but we all have these genes. They're the genes that look after our cells, make them behave themselves, make them develop properly and stay in the right place. And if you get genetic change in those genes, then you may get a malignant transformation or cancer. So why don't we all get cancer then? Well, simply because it's a chance process, but also there's obviously an environmental side to it as well. And so the idea is now that probably as we get older, we all damage our DNA and get more likelihood to get mutations in these cells. That's why the rate of cancer increases with age. But added to that, you've got environmental agents which damage our DNA and could make it more likely to you get changes in these genes. So cancer is a genetic disease, but it's not one we inherit. There are a few rare cancers we do inherit, but most of them, it's damage to a cell population, and then that damage is passed on to the progeny, which is damage you acquire during your life. And that's already had major implications for cancer diagnosis, but also for treatment. Quite amazing to me, actually, that you could take one form of chronic leukemia where the oncogenes get kind of mixed up together due to a break in the chromosomes. And this funny new gene produces an enzyme called a kinase. Well, we have kinases all over the body and they're vital for life. But it's been possible to make a drug against this one specific abnormal product that has been extremely helpful in the treatment of that form of leukemia. Quite a few of these drugs now appearing directed at the genetic defect in the cancer cell, and I think you'll see a lot more of that. That works, and it's going to work increasingly. So I would guess that for the other common diseases, that type of approach will gradually have more and more application, but not transformation of the scene overnight.
You mentioned earlier that it might be possible for the GP to look at your genome and see what your risks you might be exposed to. Aren't there some major ethical implications to that?
Well, of course, there are huge ethical implications in this whole field. That particular question, probably not actually, because there are huge discussions about who should have availability of your DNA. There will have to be a lot of care about kind of confidentiality of individuals' particular genomes. The way the government are moving at the moment, we're all going to have our kind of DNA fingerprints, which is not a genome, the whole genome, but it's a pattern. So there are huge problems in privacy. If a GP has your genome print out and he knows that you've got susceptibility to this and that, does this have implications for insurance? Does it have implications for work? The insurance business is very difficult, actually. There's been huge debate in both, in many countries about this. And in this country, there are only one or two genetic diseases, I think, where the companies are allowed to kind of load the insurance. It's very difficult, actually. I mean, logically speaking, I mean, the companies can load you if you're overweight. So logically speaking, why shouldn't they be allowed to load you if you've got a gene which makes you much more likely to get this or that? At the moment, it's more or less on hold. I think there are going to be big problems for the future, that type of issue, whether there are certain genetic makeups that make you at higher risk for certain occupations. I mean, monogenic or single gene colorblindness, you don't want a bus driver who can't see the difference between red and green. I mean, that's fairly obvious, but I mean, there are a lot of occupations where genetic variability may make you slightly more prone to some of the environmental risks, and how much of that should be made known. And the more we know about the genome, the more of these kind of borderline problems are going to appear. So, yeah, there will be ethical issues.